Well, hello there. Who are you?
This is the Zodiac speaking.
Killing must feel good to God, too. He does it all the time. And are we not created in his image?
We all go a little mad sometimes.
After all, murder is, or should be, an art.
I could kill you now pretty easily. Do some interesting things before anyone showed up.
What are these films you can't wait to look at?
Welcome to the Final Girls Podcast and the 8th episode of our series dedicated to on-screen serial killers of horror film history. I'm Anna Bogutska, your podcast host, and one of the movies we're discussing today made me never want to eat chips again. It's the 1980s now, peak John Hughes teen film era, and the two films we're covering in today's episode are concerned with the strange dynamic created between a serial killer figure and the teenager they become obsessed with winning over. The first is The Hitcher, a cult road movie from 1986 about a deranged, chaotic, and mysterious figure played by Dutch legend Rutger Hauer. The second is a lesser-known family horror starring Terry O'Quinn, most known for his role as John Locke on Lost, as the stepfather, a conservative-leaning serial killer obsessed with the idea of creating a perfect family, even if it means trying a few times and killing a few people along the way. I'm joined in this episode by the excellent writer and scholar Stacey Abbott to discuss both films in depth. Keep up with the other serial killer movies we're covering in the series over on our Letterboxd page, which I'll link in the show notes. And if you want more non-killer adjacent content, head over to our Patreon page where I post bonus reviews and discussions. And if that's not your bag at the moment, I'd appreciate a review on Apple Podcasts. And with all of that said, please enjoy our take on The Hitcher and The Stepfather. Stacey, thank you so much for giving up a bit of your time today to talk about two unhinged serial killers.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
It is the best kind of post-lunch type of recording.
Yeah, it is. It is. Just what you want is a little mayhem and murder.
So since it's our first time recording together, I'm going to ask you the question that I ask every single one of my first time guests. What is your own personal relationship with horror?
That's a big question. I suppose for me, I've been a fan of horror since I was a kid. I was the youngest of five children, which meant that the attitude and about watching things was more relaxed by the time I came around. My parents are much more like, whatever, and my bedtimes, my viewing kind of more was more in keeping with my older siblings. So I used to watch loads of horror movies on TV at home, and my parents and my brothers would tell me stories about films that I was too young to watch. So I was always really intrigued by that. So I kind of grew up with really a fascination with it. And I also like to give credit to my mom, who was a bit of a closet horror fan.
Oh.
Who would probably never have described herself as a fan of horror films, but she couldn't resist it. She would, we would watch, Halloween on TV. And I always remember watching, I was writing an essay on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So I was dutifully watching it and rewatching it, taking notes. And she kept walking through the room as I was doing this to go do laundry or something. And she couldn't stop. So she kept sitting down to watch this film with me.
Oh my God,
and I kept saying, Mom, you really are a fan. She was like, no, but I cannot tear away myself away from this. So I think my mom has a lot of lots to answer for, I suppose.
That is such a precious image. I love that.
It is, particularly with her, because she would have like a big pile of laundry on in her arms, and then she would just sit down with it on
That's
her lap.
That's what I was imagining, kind of a, you know, a woman kind of crossing the doorway yeah. of a living room with a giant pile of laundry in her hands, being like, oh, who's getting murdered now?
Exactly. The screaming, I cannot resist.
And, you know, bringing it into the series that I'm doing this over the next couple of months on a podcast, what do you think when you think about the movie Serial Killer?
Well, I think a couple of things. One thing is I think about is that I, in some respects, I always felt with most movie serial killers, I always felt safe watching them because they are so regimented and ritualized. I always felt, what are the odds I would fit the ritual? What are the odds I would be who they would select? So I would watch them and go, yeah, I don't fit that formula. I'm good. I feel safe. So I always felt like that was quite comforting to think, ah, no, the odds are. And every once in a while, though, you come across a one where you went, oh, no, they've got no rules. That, you know, I am completely at risk of this one. So that is one thing I think of. But the other thing, more seriously, I think for me, one of the things I'm always drawn to is that the serial killer film, in many respects, feels like our modern folklore, that it's kind of the whole mythology around serial killers is really a kind of modern era, 20th, 21st century phenomenon. They pre-exist that period, but really the kind of focus on them. And I think in some respects, they've become this sort of folklore that we keep coming back to, which is why I think these stories get told and retold because there's a kind of, you know, there's a desire to kind of retell them and reshare them. And they tell us things about the world we live in and how that's changing and our relationship to the world, that the things that scare us and the things out there that threaten us. So I think there's something that folkloric about them that I find fascinating.
And I guess that especially applies to films in particular, or the strange relationship between film and true crime, which always kind of are feeding one another. But to kick off the conversation that we're having this episode about two films from the late 80s featuring two quite chaotic serial killer figures, let's start with The Hitcher from 1986. So it really fits this sort of description that you were alluding to, of kind of this almost folkloric mythical figure that seems both inspired by real life murderers but also very unlike, or at least not a direct representation of any real man. So tell me, who is the titular Hitcher and how is he introduced to us in the film?
Well, the titular Hitcher is John Ryder, or so he calls himself. And he is someone who seems to haunt the highways of Midwestern America, or at least when we're introduced to him. And we're introduced to him, not surprisingly, given the title of the film, as he is hitching a lift on a rainy, late night, empty highway, when a young sort of 18-year-old guy is driving by and decides stupidly to stop and pick him up because he's tired and wants someone to talk to keep him awake. So we're introduced to him as a shadow on the highway, kind of sticking out his thumb and asking for a lift. And very quickly, we know that he is not some, well, we know he's a threat very quickly. The film does not waste any time in telling us that this guy should not have stopped. Our hero should not have stopped. And this is a threat, as we kind of often, particularly in the 80s, we're thinking, yeah, hitchhiking is dangerous. One way, one direction or the other, it's a threat. It's a risk, and he tells us that from the start.
You're right. Within the first 10 minutes, he basically sets out his intentions, which is to kill and dismember the character played by C. Thomas Howell, who was kind of a very, you know, soft-looking 1980s American pretty boy kind of actor. And Rutger Hauer, as the Hitcher, he really comes out of the shadows. This deep, dark, black and dark blue cinematography that we get for the first 10 minutes or so of the film. And it's almost pitch black and raining, and he just comes out of nowhere and tries to take control of the vehicle and sets out that he is a killer pretty much from the very start. How do you think this very intense beginning to the film changes the dynamic of the film for us?
Well, I think it immediately sets us, like, it wrong foots us, because it says right from the start, this isn't going to be a, you know, it is a cat and mouse game, but it's not going to be something where we're going to have to second guess what's going to happen. It's not going to be something that's going to build up slowly in terms of its intensity. It is intense from the moment he gets in the car. It's intense from the moment he walks up to the window and knocks on the window to be let in. And C. Thomas Howell's first words to him are, "My mother always told me never to do this." And so we know right away, and it sets up this intensity of saying no. And his behavior from the minute he gets in the car is, you know, he just won't answer the question, which is, "Where are you going?" Mm-hmm. He doesn't answer. He has these odd gestures. He's like wiping off the rain. He's asking for a cigarette. He's not engaging with the Thomas Howell character, Jim, I think it is. Mm-hmm. And we're not engaging with Jim, you know, and I think that sets up an intensity that says, no, this is our starting point. Where is this film going to go? If within the beginning, he is setting himself up as dangerous, we know very quickly that he has already murdered someone else, because we had seen a car pass by Jim earlier, just in the opening minutes of the film, a kind of Beetle, if I remember, a Volkswagen Beetle drives by and passes Jim. And then in the car, they go by and they see it pulled over on the side of the road, and he forces Jim to go drive past it. That says, okay, he knows something. He's done something already. And then he basically tells Jim, yes, I killed him. Mm-hmm. I killed the guy. So I think it's right from the start, it says this isn't going to be a slow, suspenseful build of will he, won't he hurt Jim. No, he is going to. His intention is to kill, and his intention is more than that. And I think then it becomes a question of, if he's sort of telling him right from the start, this is what I'm going to do to you, then what is his real intention out of Jim? What is his intention, you know, of what is he trying to get out of Jim as his victim? And I think that just completely changes the tone of the film, that it's not just about violence. There's something else. It's setting up a kind of psychological mind game between the two of them, which becomes the focus of the film.
And I think that's what one of the things that's most surprising about it as well. This is a first time watch for me. I'd heard about The Hitcher. I've always wanted to watch it, and I sort of expected it to be a by the numbers 80s slasher. But this intense start, the setting out of the, I was going to say the identity, but actually it's the lack of identity of the killer, and the lack of importance that is given to who he is, sets us up for this weird psychological stalking film, almost, where he has so many chances to kill Jim. And then I think that he ends up not taking them because in order to extend the game with him, in order to keep chasing him around, in order to make him more and more desperate. But ultimately, I kept, and I say this kind of as a compliment to the film, I kept trying to guess what John's motives were, and I kept coming up lacking. What do you think is his ultimate, what do you think he's playing at throughout the film?
Yeah, that is the question for the film, is what is Ryder trying to do? Like, what is this? And I know there's, you know, I think everyone has their thinking.
Yeah.
The more I watch it, and I, you know, I've watched it again for this, I've seen it quite a few times. Mm-hmm. I think part of what he's trying to get Jim to do is to kill him, is to kill him.
Oh.
Now, I don't get it in a, he's so miserable with being a serial killer that he's looking for, you know, it's not some suicidal desire into me, but somehow, like, it's the challenge. It's saying, no, it's he keeps pushing Jim. And one of the first things he says to Jim is, when Jim says, "What do you want me to do?" He says, I want you to stop me. And that for me is a big thing that he's trying to get. Now, whether he genuinely wants him at that, particularly the beginning, wants Jim to kill him, I don't know, or if it's just a game. But as the film goes, I think that becomes the challenge, is can he turn this very kind of very typical middle American teenager into someone who will kill him, and who can kill him. And I think for me, that is a big part of the motivation of his character. The more I watch it, I just think, you know, you're everything he's doing is engineering Jim to be able to do that. Why, we don't know. This is where the mythology comes into it. This is where I don't think he is like I don't like to turn some kind of pop psychology on Ryder. Mm-hmm. For me, that doesn't work. I think he eludes that. So I don't think, even by saying, I think he's trying to get Jim to kill him, it's not because I think he has a suicidal desire to die. You know, it's a game, and it's power. And it's a challenge. So I think for me, that is the big part of what's going on there, and how when I watch it, what I keep coming away with is saying this is a twisted challenge to turn Jim into a killer.
I think it's so interesting to hear you say that, because as I was watching it and as I hear you speak, what I'm thinking of is not necessarily that he wants to be killed or vanquished in some way by Jim, but rather he maybe wants to fabricate, to create a new killer, someone to take over the highway, to continue murdering people and spreading chaos after he's gone. Not alongside him, but almost replacing him.
Absolutely. I would agree with that too. I think that, because that is the process we see in this film. We see Jim kind of going from scared and defensive. So his first kind of point where he fights back, it is purely instinctually defensive by pushing Ryder out of the car. But with each stage, you could see him becoming more equipped, more, you know, and he, you know, he's brought to different points of crisis where he is, you know, he can stop, he can, you know, where he breaks down, and then eventually he rebuilds himself as someone who is a killer, or who can kill him. And so I can see that completely being part of what Ryder's trying to do. There's something about him. Again, it's that kind of perpetuating the kind of mythology, perpetuating. Someone's got to stalk those back highways, you know. Someone's got to be there. You know, he needs to plan for the future. You know?
Yeah,
he won't always be there.
It's a succession plan, really. It's
like, exactly.
Someone has to be out there murdering. It has to be a murderous hitchhiker. That's a full. It's a full job. It's a mythical job, really.
Absolutely. So you pick someone who's young, 18, got a very long life ahead of him.
Knows how to drive, can drive long distances.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it, kind of I wanted this to be the next point. Kind of, how do you think this imagery and the myth of the highway comes into play into the film? Because a big chunk of it is essentially taking place on the road and in these in-between spaces that exist on the long stretches of highway, you know, like the gas station, the dirty diner that's kind of on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere. How do these play into the film?
Well, I think they're absolutely crucial to it. I mean, to me, this film, you know, it is this wonderful mixture of horror film and road movie. Like, it is, you know, it is about, and I always think there are lots of different types of road movies, and you can have the It's a Wonderful Life, It Happened One Night type road movies, which is all about going out on the road and learning to be better people and, you know, finding your love and growing as a person. Or you could have the ones that say, actually, the road is a really dangerous place and, you know, you're alone and it's threatening and there are monsters out there that are going to get you, human or not. And for me, the road is really important here in that sense. It's about saying that it provides a background that allows these long journeys, dangerous, to isolate characters. You're isolated, particularly in that American landscape. As beautiful as it is frighteningly empty. And you need that emptiness to really put characters like Jim in at risk there, that they have there's no one out there to save you. But there's also a desolateness to it, you know, that they shoot, you know, he's endlessly finding these little cafes or gas stations, but they're almost always empty, closed. Mm-hmm. You know, they're dusty, like they look like they've been abandoned. It's a ghost town. I think there's something about that landscape that is about saying that there's this kind of lost America out there that is just, that is empty, or even when he gets to the cafe where he meets Nash, it's before it's open. She's the only one there. There's a kind of lostness to this world. And she talks about everyone who turns up there are going somewhere. They're all aspiring to go to California. There's an aspiration to being on the road, but you know, where do they get? And I think that landscape is really important for saying, actually, this is a place that's really dangerous and where people get lost and they disappear. And it's so easy to disappear there.
Oh, there's also a kind of lawlessness because all of these murders are happening pretty much in the open air in broad deadline. There's this menace. And we start in the middle of the night, but then very quickly it's daybreak. But John Ryder doesn't stop. You know, he's just out there constantly, whether that be day or night. He seems to be a character, a figure that doesn't sleep at all and will just attack in broad daylight, in someone else's car, in a moving or a stationary vehicle, in a cafe. He's always there, kind of menacing, even if there are no shadows.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, going back to the lawlessness of it. Mm-hmm. You know, the film very self-consciously calls it, you know, refers or evokes Westerns and this idea of this empty landscape as being where there are no rules. And I think you're right. And the fact that it's shot, like I said, I think the opening at night is important. It sets the atmosphere. It sets up that tension, and also and that moment of why someone like Jim would stop and pick someone up. But you're right. I think the thrust of the film and the real scary unsettlingness of the film is the fact that the majority of it takes place in not just daylight, but blisteringly bright daylight. Mm. And Ryder is unafraid. He is he really is seemingly mythological, the way in which he just kind of appears everywhere. He haunts every stop, you know, and I mean, I've heard people criticize the film and say, oh, it's not logical. How can he get there? And I think that's kind of the point. The point is he will always appear. He is there. He haunts these landscapes, and there's no one there to stop him. There's no one there to stop him. The police, what does Nash say? There was a murder. There was a shooting recently in her cafe, and it took the police 45 minutes to get there. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just no one out there to stop him or see him. And it makes him all the more dangerous because it makes you realize, like, when you see the other people who do, you know, obviously we open where we know he's murdered someone in the VW car. And then there's another car we see where he's with a family. Like we can see the evidence of him murdering these people. Those people, you know, you have to assume die very quickly. You know, that they are victims of him very quickly. So he, you know, he dispatches and moves on. No one sees it. No one stops him. And the only one who does seem to see anything is Jim. Jim's the witness as well as the, I don't know, tutor, you know, the killer to be.
Yeah.
The killer in training. The student. And so I think that sense of putting it in the bright daylight is about saying, actually, there is no safe place to hide. Mm. It's, you know, everything is up for grabs here.
And let's talk about the figure of John Ryder and specifically Rutger Hauer's performance, the great Dutch actor who became very known in, at least in his American productions, as being a go-to villain. I think especially after his role as Rory Batty in Blade Runner. Kind of, how does he play the Hitcher?
He plays it beautifully. Like he plays it so strangely and ambiguously. And I was I saw an interview with him where he talked about the fact that at this point in his career, he was saying, I want to give up playing villains. I don't want to play any more villains. And then he gets the script for The Hitcher. And what does he do? He plays the most villainous villain he could possibly play. But I think there's something about him that plays the character really ambiguously. He's not ambiguous in that he's obviously a villain. He's obviously a monster, but he's enigmatic. He doesn't disclose much about anything about himself. There is something, he has lots of strange, kind of very Rutger Hauer-ish kind of gestures and expressions, lots of strange smiles that are unexplained, or a lot of props he uses. He has a handkerchief that he uses quite a bit in the film in the beginning, where he's kind of wiping the raindrops, but then later on he wraps the bullets in it, or he even waves it at Jim as he drives away in a car, like he's like surrender, but it's hardly a surrender. There's something kind of wonderfully nuanced in Hauer's performance, which in some respects I can't imagine anyone else playing this character. They did look to various other people before him, and yet it's hard to imagine anyone playing someone who is both charismatic in a strange way, in the sense that he is very visually gripping to watch. Like every time he turns up on screen, he commands that screen. You can't look away, in the way that Jim can't look away.
Yeah.
And there's something just really like mesmerizing is probably the right word for his performance, which I think is key to the character, because he is gradually mesmerizing Jim.
He's also deeply menacing, even when he doesn't say anything. And the way that he delivers, I think a lot of his menace is concentrated in his delivery. The way that he just describes cutting off a man's limbs and then killing him, or in the scene in the diner in particular, where Jim is holding this gun that's unloaded under the table, and he just, his eyes break out into this sort of mocking laugh.
You stay seated right where you are, or I'll blow your brains through your ass.
The gun is empty.
Yeah? Yeah.
Yeah. You never checked it, did you?
So help me, I'll blow you in half.
All right. Squeeze the trigger.
I will.
Please.
Oh, I will.
Because you can sure as shit bet I'm gonna squeeze mine.
He cannot fathom how this kid, this boy, thinks that he's going to attack him or even protect himself. And he sort of has that chaotic, jokerish energy where you cannot tell what he's capable of, what he's going to do next, whether he has any limits at all. And because you do know whether this is a man who has limits, he sort of ceases to be a man at all. There's no way to grab him. He's sort of like this psychotic phantom that appears out of nowhere, always seems to be sweating, and is grinning at every inopportune moment. And it has also this kind of sick kind of sense of humor that I think translates into the actual gore and the violence of the movie. Like when Jim finds a severed finger amongst his fries in the diner.
Yes.
How did he put that in there? Whose finger is that? Why is that a joke?
Yeah, absolutely. I know, it's one of those great moments, and I keep going back to when I watch it and go, how did that happen? Where is he? Like, is he under the table? Like, where is he hiding? But it's a really, there is something great about the way in which he plays this. Not like he's not playing it for humor, but it's like he is the one on the inside of the joke. He always is kind of, he's got the upper hand on Jim. He finds Jim bemusing at times, because Jim's trying to stand up to him, and particularly that scene, the bit in the diner, is great because you could see him kind of egging Jim on, but also going, you're not ready yet. Like, you're not ready. Like, you're not going to do it. You're not up to this. And there's something kind of wonderful about the way Howard plays that. And it is really unsettling. It is really menacing because it's like he knows the full script. And we don't yet. Yeah. He knows where it's going. I know exactly where we're going here. I know exactly what buttons to push and how to push them and how long it's going to take. And I will just keep sitting back. So he does keep turning up because he turns up like the cafe bit with the finger where suddenly I was rewatching that bit and going, where, like, you know, because there was because it's two things. It's the finger, but also that he plants the knife on Jim. And I was going, when does he do that? And then I went and back and you look back and you go, okay, Jim leaves his jacket in the cafe when he goes to make the phone call and then goes to clean up. So you're going, at some point or other, he sneaks in, drops a finger in the French fries, drops a knife, a bloody knife in the pocket, steals his wallet, and all within like the 4 minutes, 3 minutes it takes him to kind of wash his face and brush his hair. And there's something, and he does that. And then later on, like, it's like, and this is where that landscape is really important. We keep getting these really big, wide shots of this empty landscape. And yet suddenly he'll appear watching to know exactly when the right moment to turn up to shoot the police so that Jim can't turn himself in. And Jim has to keep going. And, you know, and he's like his timing. So you're going, well, wait a minute. Where were you hiding? Like, where were you that you could just suddenly drive up now, precisely at this moment? Because it's like he knows exactly, like he is just on the other side of the frame, knows exactly where to hide. And I like that. There's something about, it's like he is in control of the narrative.
Absolutely. And he almost, as the film escalates, particularly in the scope of its violence towards the final scene where Nash, who's the diner waitress played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, gets literally torn apart as she's tied between two trucks. We're only getting to that point because he allows it to get to that point. It's not that he's allowing himself to be caught or seen or to be identified by the police as the real killer, because he'd been framing Jim up until that point as the potential highway killer. It's almost like this is the final play that he does. And it has to be extravagant. It has to be big. And as we were saying before, I think it has to be that big so that he can force Jim to become the killer that he's training him to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can see the escalation. You know, the first two deaths happen off screen. We don't see anything. We just see the cars by the road. Jim sees a bit. We don't see it. And then we get the shootings with the police. That's on camera, but they're shooting. You know, it gets increasingly kind of broad and visualized. And then we build up to, Nash's death, which is a tour de force moment of the film where he really is saying, he is sitting in the front of this cab. He has tied this woman between two trucks that will rip her apart. Like, this is a huge gesture. And you're right. I think in some respects, I keep wondering, I don't know how much Jim being framed. I mean, Jim is being framed. He plants the knife. But I think that's almost a byproduct. Like, it is like, yes, that just allows him to just keep making it more and more difficult.
Well, it forces it forces Jim to pay attention.
Yeah, exactly.
To never let his guard down.
Yeah. And to stay on the road because he has to keep going. He has to stay on the road. Because he has to try to escape, like, you know, and work out what, because, you know, Jim is endlessly trying to turn himself. I mean, you know, he's endlessly trying to turn himself in. He keeps doing it, saying, I want to turn myself in. Please let me turn myself in. And John Ryder says, nope, you were going to. So he has these moments where, you know, he pushes him. So we get to this big sequence. Just to give nod to that other sequence that I think is a really key one, is when Jim has turned himself in and is in jail. And Ryder, again, it's off camera. It's happened while Jim is a very deep sleeper, that he's in jail. And Ryder's come in and killed the police officers. And you get this really surreal, disturbing scene that Jim finds as he walks through this empty station to find not only the police officers all dead, but it's, to me, I will forever be scarred by the sound of the police dog lapping up the blood of the police officer, which I found really disturbing. Like, it's a really unsettling and it's almost nightmarish moment where you, and you can see Jim going, is this real? Like, you know, and I think, so you get these rather baroque moments that I think set up the escalation of what he's doing to build to the sequence with Nash. And you're right. I think it is about pushing Jim to finally become a killer. And even then, even in this moment, he can't do it. Like, he still can't do it. Partly because Ryder keeps putting him in these scenarios. That sequence in the van, in the front of the truck, where they're talking, feels like a repeat of the opening sequence when Ryder is in the car, because both of them, he is saying, you need to do this, you need to stop me, and it takes the killing of Nash to push Jim into a position to be able to become the killer the Ryder wants him to be. So, like, again, caught by the police is a byproduct.
And I wanted to ask you, I wanted to talk a little bit about the screenwriter of The Hitcher, Eric Red, who, this is his first film, has a bit of a mythical kind of story about how he delivered the script to producers saying that they weren't going to sleep for a week after reading it, and they weren't going to sleep for a week after the movie got made. And then he went on to write several films for Catherine Bigelow, including Near Dark, which I know you love and you've written the book about, and also Blue Steel, which is, I think, is one of the most interesting Bigelow films that doesn't get discussed as often. He then went on to write the remake of The Hitcher as well in 2007. Kind of knowing that you love Near Dark so much, do you see any similarities between The Hitcher and Near Dark, which would be his subsequent film?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think they're really interesting parallel texts, partly because of the landscape. Again, similar play of light and shadow. You know, it's all taking place somewhere between this clash between day and night as our characters are circulating on the roads. But I think more importantly, I think there's a lot of parallels between Ryder and the vampires in Near Dark, as these almost like in Near Dark, it's like it takes it to an actual mythological kind of reality where they're vampires. They haunt these back roads. But I think more important, it's not just that they're vampires, but it's like they're unstoppable. They just keep going. And there's something about Ryder that's very similar to them in that respect, that they just keep moving and have no issue with, nothing can threaten them.
And where do you see the legacy of The Hitcher? You know, do you see its influence in other films?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think it's, I'm trying to think, I'm not sure if I think a film, it's hard to reproduce. I mean, it's had an interesting legacy. It's been, as you said, there's sequels, there's remakes, which I have sort of avoided because I love the original so much and went, no, you know, particularly the sequel. Like, Jim would never pick up a hitchhiker again. I find that impossible to believe. But I think there's something about that idea of the kind of stalker, and someone training someone to be, I mean, I know you're going to talk about this in a separate episode, but I was even thinking of something like the TV series of Hannibal, that sense of this wonderfully disturbed relationship between a killer and someone he is trying to push to become a killer and to become like him, and the psychological line. And so it's not so much that, you know, that's a legacy, but there's a correlations there I see there, where you're seeing this idea of the serial killer being a genre that allows to explore these kind of twisted relationships. If that's a good legacy for this film.
Well, these twisted dynamics as well, because one of the things that I find quite interesting about The Hitcher as a standalone film, I too have avoided the sequel, but it's this idea that an obsession can be born out of something so completely random. You know, Jim is not a character that the Hitcher has stalked or identified or that fits, you know, a particular profile. He seems to be a completely random kind of killer, but their one interaction creates this obsession that will not be stopped until it reaches its natural conclusion in the death of one of them. And I find that to be quite scary and fascinating in itself, that you don't have to fit a particular profile to become this target of an obsession by a movie killer.
Absolutely. And going back to, you know, talking about Eric Red's other work, I mean, that ties in very well with Blue Steel, where again, you have this random moment of a police officer stopping a robbery in a convenience store.
Yeah.
And being observed by someone who then picks up the gun and becomes this killer. And it becomes this, again, a wonderfully twisted cat and mouse game between the killer and the police officer, which gets even more, in a very Catherine Bigelow way, gets even more convoluted by them developing a sexual relationship as well, that it takes in, you know, in that direction more overtly. And so I think there is something about that, the idea that, you know, this a random moment can can lead to obsession, which I suppose is the nature of stalking. And stalking is that, you know, it can be these random things that suddenly leads to obsession. And the serial killer genre, I think, explores that in a really disturbing way. So I started this podcast saying part of the comfort of the serial killer is feeling I won't fit the profile. Mm-hmm. But you do get these films which say actually there is no profile.
Yeah.
There is no profile. You know, these things could be anyone. Mm-hmm. And it's are you in the wrong place, the wrong time? You know, and if it, okay, here this one is precipitated by picking up a hitchhiker, which is not a wise thing to do. But, you know, he's doing it. He's trying to stay awake. It makes complete sense to him. Like, what are the odds that it would be a mythological serial killer who's going to try to push him into becoming a murderer? Like, it doesn't seem realistic to Jim, naively on the road going to California, you know, you know, for a better life. Mm-hmm. So I think there is something about that randomness that is when a serial killer film really gets to me. It's because I feel there's a randomness to it that could be anyone. And if it's not that person on screen, it could be you, it could be anyone.
And interestingly, it's the complete opposite of the next serial killer we're going to be covering. Jerry in The Stepfather, who very specifically targets women with a child so he can manufacture the perfect all-American nuclear family. And The Stepfather is a film from 1987, so they're very close together, and similarly to The Hitcher, starts very economically and very brutally by very quickly introducing us to who Jerry is, played by Terry O'Quinn, what his outward persona is, and what his inward personality is like. So what is your relationship with this film? Had you seen it before? Were you aware of the Stepfather franchise?
I had seen it. I came to it later than The Hitcher. The Hitcher was one I came to sort of right around the time it came out, or at least on video. The Stepfather I came to later, I was sort of vaguely aware of it as a franchise. Then I think it was recommended to someone by me, no, you should give this a go. And so it was in the kind of mid-90s, I think, that I saw it. My relationship was, I was immediately drawn to it. And I have to say, I also used to teach it on a horror class I taught. It's kind of family horror. And I always loved it. I think it's a really rich film because none of my students would have seen it. And it was a great one to kind of talk about family horror. So my relationship is one of saying, like, I really was drawn into that critique, very unsubtle critique of Reaganite family values or 1980s American family values discourses. I just went, no, this is a film that is absolutely knows what it's doing. It's not trying to be subtle. It's not trying to be vague. It is wearing its meaning right on its sleeve to make a very kind of overt comment on kind of middle America. Which I think works really well. And I think there's something, again, like, it comes out late 80s, sort of, you know, in the latter part of that kind of first, you know, that kind of that wave of slasher films. And it's a film as well that has a relationship with the slasher film, but isn't quite a slasher film. And I think that I've always really enjoyed is a kind of, it sits alongside slasher films in really interesting ways.
Mm. How do you think it sits alongside slasher films?
Well, because I think it's got the teen protagonist,
mm-hmm.
Who in various ways is kind of coded as the final girl at the end, mm-hmm. in the sense that she, even though she's not alone, but that she is kind of coded in her being stalked by Jerry, that she's being presented as someone who is overtly, you know, is trying to escape this. It's coded a lot, you know, it's a lot, sits alongside it. Even all the references to Psycho at the end, you know, with the shower scene and the butcher knife and him walking up the stairs with the butcher knife. And we're kind of leaping to the end. We've already talked about the beginning. But I think it's kind of, it's sort of recognizing the relationship, but it's not a slasher film in the traditional sense because, you know, whereas The Hitcher is all about, you know, killings all the way from the beginning. This one, we get a brutal opening, the aftermath of a killing, and then we spend a lot of time just watching Jerry be unhappy with his family, you know, and trying to make them into a better family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I think that is very different. It becomes much more suspenseful, like watching those moments where he's beginning to crack, because we've seen from the opening this really disturbing introduction of, you know, him, you know, we're introduced to him covered in blood, you know, cleaning himself up and tidying himself up and cutting his hair and changing his look and then walking out the house as he passes by the bodies of his wife and children.
It's a brutal image.
It really is.
It really shocked me, actually. When I settled in to watch it, I was not expecting it to show an image like that in the first 5 minutes. It really starts with this very intense opposition of imagery of this, like, well-groomed, very, you know, quite conservative-looking middle-aged man walking out with his briefcase and his tie and his vest out of this perfect suburban home. But behind him, as he closes the doors, he walks down the stairs. Every single surface is covered in blood. There's dead children. There's a dead woman. Everyone is sort of, it's a bloodbath. And he barely even looks at them. And he doesn't have a single drop of blood on him as soon as he leaves that house. And he sort of leaves away and suddenly there's a time jump and he's got a brand new family. Yeah. He's, can't remember, is he recently engaged or like fully married to a new woman who's got a teenage daughter? And he seems to be this picture perfect image of a suburban dad, but we already know who he is, what he's capable of. So the question there, similarly to John Ryder in The Hitcher, is we already know what you're capable of. So what is it that, what is your goal? What is your game?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that opening when he walks down the stairs, what I was struck watching again was not only is he tidy and cleaned up, there's not a speck of blood, he actually pauses to put the toys away in the toy box, move the chair because it's been fallen over. Mm-hmm. He tidies. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that sense as he walks out. So by the time he walks out the door, or even, I mean, from the point we were introduced to him, we see the aftermath, but we don't see Jerry the killer. We don't see him yet, how he enacts it. But so what we see is him now, he is constructing the perfect appearance of normality and conservativeness, and just this, he walks out looking like he belongs. And it's that shot of him walking out onto the street, you know, close the doors, walks up past the neighbors, whistling zippity-doo-da, you know, like nothing has happened. And it is a really horrifying introduction to someone. And then, like I said, you're right. You move immediately to the new family, the new life, and it becomes this, like, if we're thinking of him as a serial killer, mm-hmm. it is one of the most disturbing evocations of what a serial killer can do, because this is not random. This is not, I'm just picking someone on the street. No, it is about planning and stalking and finding people that fit some incredibly constructed idea of what he's looking for.
Yes, it's not the fantasy.
It is. Exactly. And that he, in constructing this fantasy, he is setting up these people to be his next victims, even if he wants them to be this perfect fantasy. It's a fantasy. It's mm-hmm. impossible. No one will live up to that expectation. Therefore, they are doomed mm-hmm. once they meet him, once Completely. He picks them.
Because also, and this I think is one of the biggest successes of the movie, because we get to see this cracked, warped version of a fantasy of an all-American, of a perfect family that Jerry is after. But he never shares this fantasy. It's completely in his mind. He doesn't really articulate it. We get glimpses of it because probably it's not realistic. It's not fully formed. There's actually no room for other people to be a part of this fantasy. Other people are little dolls in a dollhouse that he's trying to construct. Yes. And they keep coming up short to his ideal because they have their own volition and their own personality, and life is messy and people change. And that is unacceptable to someone like Jerry. And I find it to be such a chilling glimpse into this type of killer. You know, there's tons of examples in real life of sort of family annihilator killers, or the whole premise of profiling is sort of based on recreating and understanding the fantasy of a serial killer to try to prevent future crimes. Mm-hmm. And here we've seen a failed version of a family, and we're seeing him try to build a new fantasy. And what's interesting watching these two films back to back is that while John Ryder is complete chaos, and that's where the menace lies, the menace of Jerry is that he's highly organized. He's got a methodology. He's got a system. And if something starts falling apart, then he very quickly moves on to the next iteration, trying to perfect the next family. So how does Jerry operate? What's his methodology?
Well, first of all, it's to prey on vulnerable women, you know, or women he perceives as vulnerable, i.e. they're raising a family on their own. In the case of the mother in this one, she's, you know, recently widowed and says to her daughter, I thought that was my one chance at happiness, and I never thought I'd be happy, you know, I'd have that kind of happiness again. So he's preying on people who are vulnerable, or who he sees as vulnerable. So that's what there's something really Machiavellian about that, the way he insinuates himself and then tries to construct around him this perfect family. So, you know, he brings home the puppy to his now stepdaughter to try to win her over and create that image. Even the choices of new careers he picks become about constructing this image of the perfect all-American family. So mm-hmm. he becomes a real estate agent selling houses mm-hmm. in his own neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and he has that horrible scene where he has the barbecue, where he's invited all of his former clients to come to a family barbecue because they're now his neighbors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so he's selling, and he says, I'm selling the American dream. And then later on, when he sets up his new identity, he becomes an insurance salesman. He's interested in family policies. So, you know, there's something about the careers he picks that are about constructing and continuing to foster his ideas about some twisted sense of what kind of family values are. And then how he tries to manipulate the people around him to conform to that. So he, you know, the way he manipulates the needs of his wife. And I find it quite disturbing sex scene between Jerry and his wife, mm-hmm. intercut with the daughter kind of in presumably the next room, putting headphones yeah. on, not wanting to hear this. It's a really unsettling scene. But when you get the close-up of him, he's really cold. There's something really cold and calculated about this. This is not, you know, there's no attraction. There's no arousal here. It is.
Well, he's performing.
He is. It's a continued performance.
Mm-hmm. And I think kind of, you know, not to get too ahead of ourselves, but yeah. that performance is what starts to crack throughout the film. And those are my favorite moments where he sort of is so consumed and taken by his own narrative that he's creating, that he slips in and out of these different roles yeah. that he's created for himself.
No, forget it, honey. Forget it. She probably just got the name wrong or something.
Hodgkins, what's to get wrong?
What did you say?
Huh? Wait a minute. Who am I here?
Jerry.
Jerry? Jerry Blake. Thank you, honey.
He calls himself by a different name and people call him out on it. He is telling a child about his daughter, a fake version of the real Stephanie, that's his stepdaughter, and kind of calls her by a different name or makes some error in the recounting. And even the little girl picks up on it. And he has this sort of like lost in reverie air about him when he goes into these dreamlike states of what the ideal family is. So what does the perfect family look for Jerry, this ultimate goal of his?
It's the perfect family, I think, is one that he can control. It's one where they all fit their roles, the dutiful wife, the adoring daughter or the adoring children, and I think who are straight. And he describes when he makes that slip about the daughter and then corrects himself. He then also fabricates her story and says, you know, she's on the, you know, at the yearbook committee or something like that, like school council. She's on school's council. She's a straight A student. She, you know, he's fabricating this idea of what she should be. Of course, the reality is the film then cuts to her in a fight in her art class where she's getting into a fight with one of the other students. Mm-hmm. So she's not this. But I think he's looking to create this fabrication of the perfect, dutiful daughter, the adoring wife, and trying to, and something that he can control and that they all look up to him and will never change. I think one of the problems that where his desire to control is doomed, mm-hmm. why every one of these families is doomed, is because kids grow up. So even if they were adoring children, they're going to grow up. And so even at the point when he wins Stephanie over, and, you know, and preys upon her weakness at a weak moment to suddenly insinuate himself in with her so that she finally stops suspecting him.
Mm-hmm.
But then he completely ruins it because he catches her kissing a boy.
Yeah.
And suddenly he explodes and you see that, no, she is growing up. She's a teenager. She's 16 and she's kissing a boy. Mm-hmm. And he comes out with these kind of ridiculous overplayed claims of he was trying to rape her, mm-hmm. and you know, and you're just going, they're all doomed because people change, people grow up, and children will always grow up and suddenly not be the little cute little dolls as you described at the beginning, mm-hmm. that he wants them to be.
And that's a futile fantasy because, as you said, everyone changes, especially the kids. So whatever family he picks, they're always going to fall short of his expectations.
Yes.
And let's talk about Terry O'Quinn's performance. Yes. Terry O'Quinn, a character actor that might be most well known to audiences for his portrayal of John Locke on the series Lost. That's definitely how I first encountered him. He's not an actor that I've seen in many leading roles. This might be one of the first that he got to play. And I'm wondering what you thought of his performance and how he plays Jerry.
I really like his performance. And I think I came to Lost after this, so
oh.
It completely skewed me to how I read Locke on Lost, because all I could see was Jerry. And I think what he does is, there's something about him. You're right. He doesn't normally play lead. He's not usually a lead actor. He has that kind of classic character actor profile. If you look at his filmography, you know, he appears in loads of things. He is very, not so, I mean, you know, average looking, look, you know, he is, you know, there's something about him that seems incredibly normal and not normal at the same time. That he seems very average, you know, conservative, looks like you completely believable as a middle American father. Mm-hmm. But there's something in his eyes that he is able to convey, even at his most performance, even when he's performing normal Jerry to the hilt, there's something slightly cold about him that he's able to bring out. And I think there's something really effective about his performance that way, that you can see the calculations in what he's doing. And I think that's something he's played on subsequent to playing this character in things like Lost, where you are always going, there's something more to this character than meets the eye.
He has that ability to have a very cold gaze, even while he's smiling or being polite. He's never rude. He's never out of step. That outburst that you were describing earlier with Stephanie is one of the few kind of losses of control that we see him have before the big crescendo at the movie's end. And it's quite striking because of that. He's so perfectly mild-mannered. He can... blend into any situation. And I think that's why he's also, as an actor, quite well suited for this role, because even with little changes, like you put a fake mustache or some mutton chops on him, or a toupee, or if he shaves his head, he will sort of change his appearance enough, but not enough to not still appear completely conventional and sort of not memorable.
I think the not memorable is really key. Mm-hmm. Is there something about him you could see, you know, people not noticing him?
Yeah.
You know, they don't notice him on the ferry when he's going in the bathroom looking like one thing and something else when he comes out. No one notices.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about him that is very just run of the mill, that there's something that he just blends wherever he is.
And I think that's also how he picks these families that he tries to mold or make fit into his idea of a perfect family, because he's not really going after, you know, particularly rich women. He's not after their money. It's not like he's murdering them for that. He is going after lower income women either, to try to manipulate them through money or that kind of economic or social power. He really is trying to go after the medium, the most average possible situation in small suburban areas. He's not going too far, but also there's something quite chilling about how he assumes that once he's gone, once he has severed a connection with a place, once he's killed a family, that no one will come looking for them. That once it's out of sight, it's out of mind, and he moves on and does not imagine that anybody who he has killed will have people who will inquire about them or miss them. And that becomes his undoing, right? When the brother of one of his victims comes looking for him and tries to find out who this shape-shifting serial killer is.
Absolutely. And I think that's really key, is that, you know, when, and there's that great moment when the brother-in-law turns up and sees him, when he, and there's something kind of wonderfully disturbing about Jerry's response, which is to say, wow, hi, I haven't seen you, it's you. He's not shocked. He's not like, oh my God, I've been caught. Mm. He is like, hi, you know, it's been ages. You back from Europe? You know, like it's just nothing. And I think that's the thing. It's where he can slip. And again, this becomes his undoing, is that the ways in which he slips in and out of these personas, because he is, you know, for each time he is undertaking this kind of planning the demise of one family in favor of the new, he is living between these two. He is moving back and forth between these identities, setting up a new identity and preparing to kill off his old one. So he's able to kind of almost like a chameleon move back and forth in that and assume that no one's going to be looking for him and no one cares. And also because once he's killed them, he's moved past. Mm-hmm. He's forgotten them and they are literally dead to him. Like literally he walks out the door and he's whistling as he goes up the street. And we see this when he kills the other sort of only non-family victim, which mm-hmm. is Stephanie's psychiatrist.
Yes.
Who is on to him, or at least is on the path to being on to him. And he kills him. But even when after he's done that, which is again it's his only full on crime of passion, in the sense that he is caught in a mistake, or no, he catches this guy and realizes he's looking for him. Mm-hmm. And then you get this really brutal murder. And of course part of the brutality isn't because he's been caught, it's because the psychiatrist had made all these disparaging comments about families. And you know, yeah. and you know there's a brutality because he's attacking what he values so much. But when he's finally then calms down and sets about disposing of the body to cover up what he's done, he's back to the meticulous planning, mm-hmm. organizing, and then walks down the road whistling zippity-doo-dah as he heads home. And you just go, no, there's something about the compartmentalizing of just, I'm now moved on and I will not be implicated here. No one will find me. No one has my, you know, there's no anxiety about forensics or fingerprints or anything like that.
He's utterly devoid of anxiety or fear. Yeah. He's in his own quiet, yeah. suburban way, the most fearless serial killer that I've covered so far amongst the movies we've seen. He has no worry in the world. He almost assumes that he won't ever be caught, that it's going to be completely up to him when to stop, when he finds the perfect family. And I do, you know, we spoke about those little fractures in Jerry's psyche, you know, especially towards the end where he just goes, has this moment where he calls himself by a different name and just goes, who am I here? You know, he's like, which one of these identities am I now? I'm wondering as well about his relationship with Stephanie and how that's characterized. Even with the title of the film, The Stepfather, the relationship with Stephanie seems to be Jerry's core preoccupation. He spends a big part of the film trying to gain her trust. How is that dynamic characterized in the film for you?
Well, you're right. I mean, it's about trying to... I think the key dynamic going on there is that in order to construct the family he's trying to build, he has to win her over. He's won the wife over. Mm-hmm. And it's somehow it's the in this case, it's her that is the stumbling block, because she is. One of the things I was thinking about, I was watching again, was that she herself is dealing with her own issues around having lost her perfect family. Mm-hmm. Her father has died. So for her, she doesn't talk about it being a perfect family in the way he does. She's mourning that. She is struggling with that. She's lost her dad. She has lost what makes sense for her family. And the stepfather embodies that loss. Like, he is a threat to that for her. So one of the things I find really interesting about the film is the ways in which the two of them becomes this battle between them, because in many ways they both have their own sense of what a family should be. And he is not her father. He is not like her father. She is immediately, she's right that he's creepy and a killer, but that's not initially what's bothering her. What bothers her is he isn't her father.
Yeah.
And she's dealing with this and she's acting out. She's not conforming to what makes the perfect daughter, because she is dealing with grief and she is dealing with trying to make sense of this and the loss. And presumably in a very Hamlet way, is trying to deal with the fact that her mother's remarried fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. From her perspective. It's a year later. It's a year since the murder. How long? And the implication is that it's not that long since her father died. Long enough that she's in therapy about it. Mm-hmm.
And it feels sort of like a betrayal on her mother's part to have moved on so quickly.
Exactly. Like, you really get that sense that she is struggling with her mom doing this. And feeling in the opening scenes when we're introduced to them, we're introduced to Stephanie, you know, and you get this wonderful dissolve between Jerry to Stephanie. Mm-hmm. And that she's now, we've just seen him like walk up his perfect suburban street, leaving the murder scene. And then we eventually dissolve to her riding her bike down another perfect suburban street. And she goes home and she has this wonderfully surreal play fight in the leaves with her mother. Like, you know, it's this ideal sense of family. And then Jerry drives up and he disrupts that. So he's the disruption to her family, to how she, her values, and she feels betrayed. And so I think there's something about the fact that they're both struggling with what they understand family to be. And that is what the dynamic, a lot of it is at play, is that she is resisting being the daughter he wants her to be in the way, and you know, and seeing him as a replacement in the way that presumably he is feeling, I am filling this gap, I am, you know, I am saving you from this lack of a father, where she sees him as trying to replace her father. Mm-hmm. And I think that sets up a really nice battle between the two of them. It's why she is able to see him more for who mm-hmm. he is. She sees the moments, the cracks. She's in the basement when he goes down and sort of has a mini little fight with himself because mm-hmm. he's angry. And you know, the, again, it's those little moments when the veneer cracks and she sees it. She's always the one, because she's watching him, because he's, you know, is invading her family or is disrupting what she, you know, her own sense of family. And she, you know, he embodies the threat, and a retrospective threat to her family, even though, you know, he turns up after her father's died, but somehow he becomes the figure that represents all of that for her.
And you mentioned the basement, Jerry's basement, where he spends a lot of his alone time. What does the basement mean for him, do you think? And also, primarily, I was very interested in the scenes where Jerry is by himself, when he's not performing, and what he's like when he's technically relaxed and showing us his true face. We never really get to know his real name, so it might be Jerry, yeah. It might not be. What does Jerry behave like when he's alone?
Well, it's interesting because we see sort of two sides of that. Like the basement is a great space because the basement is the space where he's, for the most part, unwatched. Mm-hmm. So he is able to have these moments where he gets angry and we hear him and suddenly he's talking as if he's talking to his own father or it's some other form. Like you feel like, I always feel like he's reliving his own childhood memories or his own or other fights he's had with other children, or I don't know, but he's reliving moments there. But you also, the other thing we see in that basement is him repeatedly building and constructing these little houses. So he's making birdhouses in the shape of another perfect little house for another family to mm-hmm. occupy. And the basement is a curious thing in these kinds of suburban homes because they become this man's, I mean, we joke about them being man caves.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it is this space
like a space within a space.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where they get to build things and have their tools and live up to a certain image of masculinity, and he's down there. So even like, and even when he is quote unquote could be being himself, he's still performing this image of what he thinks he should be, you know, with his tools and with his picture. He has this little family portrait, which we see this in both of the basements. When the brother-in-law goes back to the first house, he has almost like a mirror image basement with another picture of that family pinned up to the wall there, just like he has the picture of Stephanie and her mother and him in this basement. Like there's a sense where it's as much a performance there as any other part of the house, where he for himself is building this image of himself. And that's where I think there's something really interesting about him, that the performance isn't just for other people's benefits.
It's for his own. For him to convince himself that not only that maybe if he were just the perfect man, the perfect stepfather, he would be able to find that perfect family, because they would finally fit in their perfect little Reaganite suburban house.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, that he is, so they're, you know, they're, the failing that he blames on them, there's a part, those sequences in the basement also seems to be him confronting his own failing, that somehow he hasn't quite got it right. He hasn't quite got them right. He hasn't picked them right. He hasn't convinced them. And that's why some of those dialogue, but it's little monologues when he's down there, where it does seem like he's having conversations with himself or his own father or some other, you know, it just, you're going, you are rehearsing things you've lived, whether it's from your past or from some other family, you just keep rehearsing these moments and angry at them and yourself for not being able to make it work. And it's happening again.
I think it genuinely is one of the most intriguing sort of movie serial killers, so depictions of a movie serial killer, because without giving us any backstory on Jerry, and like I said, not even his real name, we get such a quite well-traced idea of where his fractures are, what his idea of himself is, and what his fantasy is, and how much he's willing to do and how far he's willing to take it to replicate, to try to reach out for that fantasy. Even, you know, in his last moment, he's so fully committed to it that even when he's killed in the final confrontation, he still mutters this "I love you" to his wife, who, you know, he's completely bought into his own idea right until the very end. I don't think he genuinely thinks of what he's doing as killings in the film. I think he just looks at it as scratching something out on a piece of paper and moving on. Like turning a blank page, and once you have, it's gone. It does not matter. It's not even real people.
No. I was thinking of it as I was watching it. It's like the etch and sketch kind of murder that he literally kills them. God. And it's like he shakes up the etch and sketch and starts over. Mm. And that, it just really is where he does, and I do think in his own twisted way, he's buying into his performance. So when he gives his speech at the barbecue and gets all emotional talking about his family, I actually think there's a part of him that, I mean, it's all performance, but it's not performance. Like his emotion, I think he's not play acting because he really wants this. This is part of him that wants this. So he is feeling emotional about his mother, his wife and daughter, because he has this moment of seeming to have it, even if in the next scene he sees a threat to it when the newspaper article comes out, which is about his the previous murder, and suddenly that's the beginning of a fracture. Mm. You know, he recognizes there's something out there. He's shocked to realize they might be looking for the person who killed this family. So there's something like he gets more violent when he realizes, when he is thrust out of his fantasy and his own belief in it, in the fantasy he's constructed. And that's when you start seeing the kind of, not just the breaks, but the violence that he is capable of, even though we don't see him perform the violence very often in the film. We see we see lots of really unsettling glimpses of it.
Mm. Well, we don't really need to see that much violence performed because the characterization is so effective.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Before we wrap up about both of these films, I know both The Hitcher and The Stepfather had their respective mid-2000s remakes. Have you seen any of these? Did you have any thoughts on them?
I have to say, no, I didn't. I couldn't bring myself to see The Hitcher one. Cause
fair enough.
I just, yeah. And Sean Bean, who I do like Sean Bean a lot, I just couldn't bring myself to see anyone but Roger Howard play that. And to be honest, I have nothing against watching The Stepfather. I think it'd be kind of interesting to see what it looks like in a more contemporary landscape. I'd be interested to see that backdrop. It's one I just haven't got to. I'm now intrigued now. I think maybe I'll go and give it a go now and see what it's like, because I'm kind of curious.
I have to say, I've not watched The Hitcher remake. Yeah. I'm not as diametrically opposed to it because The Hitcher is a new film for me. But yeah. I did watch The Stepfather remake. Yeah. It happens to be on Netflix. I was aware of it because once upon a time, I devoured every single episode of Nip Tuck. So I'm aware of Dylan Walsh, who plays the Terry O'Quinn role. And I kind of like the – I like this idea of taking – doing a remake or a reinterpretation of a film that is not super well known, that is not a super beloved property, that has a couple of great ideas or a great character that you want to re-explore with a new context. That said, The Stepfather from 2009 is not it.
Should I watch it?
Well, the quick answer is no. The long answer is it is so much more interested in the murders than it is in why a character like Jerry would be murdering someone, what an updated version of a perfect family would be in 2009. And it has all of this sort of gratuitous, weird teenage nudity. It has a lot of Penn Badgley shirtless, a lot of Amber Heard in a bikini at all points. I think in all of her scenes, she's in a bikini for sometimes for no reason whatsoever. Even the gender flipping of the characters of it being a teenage son versus the stepfather instead of it being a teenage daughter would be such an interesting new dynamic to explore, but the film isn't really interested in that. And instead what we get is a lot of post-Saw, very green, very yellow tinted scenes, and none of those interesting dynamics actually come to the forefront. It's just a straightforward slasher, with the exception of the ending, which I think they left open for potential sequels, although nobody's craving a potential sequel for the 2009 The Stepfather.
Yeah, it's not surprising they would go down that route, but it's disappointing because it just says that you don't really understand what works so well about this film is that it's not conforming to any of those cliches, and it is built up in a really good, unsettling, disturbing performance of someone trying to embody some twisted sense of kind of family values and normality. Like, I just think it's such a great film to challenge us in terms of when we use that word normal and how it can, normality is itself monstrous. Like, I go, no. And that sort of thing, going back to Terry Quinn, I think he's so good at that. Like, he really does give you a sense of being incredibly normal and showing you how frightening normal can be.
Yeah, he really embodies a kind of menacing side of quote-unquote normality.
Exactly.
And before we wrap up, Stacey, is there anything about either The Hitcher or The Stepfather or its titular serial killers that you wanted to bring up that we might not have covered?
We've covered a lot. I think one of the things that struck me watching the two of them close together was that fact that they're both, in some respects, so different.
Yeah.
Because they are, you know, one is on the road and one is about the home. One is, you know, two films that seem so different. And yet they're both focused on this very complicated relationship between the killer and this teenage person in their world, you know, that is who is the only one who really sees them for who they are and sees them. And I found that really interesting in terms of, like, coming out of the 1980s teen culture, you know, American teen, like, I'm going, no, there's something really fascinating about these two protagonists of Stephanie and Jim as these very average, normal American teenagers who are confronted by horror. And I thought that was a really interesting thing that both watching them together, I went, oh no, I really am enjoying that side of it.
Totally. And also about both of them, both Jim and Stephanie, struggling to be taken seriously and for their fears to be believed by the elders, by the adults around them. You know, Stephanie even isn't believed by her mom, so even within the fabric of their home. And Jim obviously isn't believed by more institutional powers like law enforcement and whatever, and they both kind of come off as crazy throughout the film and are vindicated very violently at the end.
Absolutely. And I think both films you hinge on these couldn't be more different performances of their serial killers, but both of them really getting under your skin that you just think, no, actually, these are the killers that scare me. The ones who you think could do anything, like Ryder, mm-hmm. or the one who is insidiously meticulous in the planning, therefore can do anything. And we see from the start both of them are capable of the most brutal violence and yet can smile.
That's a great line to end on, Stephanie. I'm sorry I called you Stephanie for a second there. Oh my God. Oh,
that's
my God.
All right.
I'm having a Jerry moment.
Yeah, because who am I here? Who am I?
I'm so sorry, Stacey. That was a real fucking Jerry moment.
That was great. No, that was good. Judge, you're on to me. You're on to me, Anna. This is my Jerry moment. Yes, who am I?
Thank you so much for your time and for your insight. It was such a pleasure to talk through both of these films with you, especially as they were both first-time watchers for me.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it. I love revisiting these films. So it was a real pleasure to kind of wallow in this for a couple of days thinking about these strange, strange men.